You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. In this episode, we're heading to France to talk to legendary proprietor and master blender Alexandre Gabriel of Maison Ferrand. We step back in time to when he was a small boy, learning how to distill from his grandfather and how those lessons of preserving the essence of the land carries through towards today. Alexandre tells us how he found Maison Ferrand and expanded into other spirits, bringing the same love and dedication to craft. Then we step into our archives with an interview and performance from Mahogany. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes on HRN.
Very much to cry together every day. We have to stay in touch, Jackie, baby. Rain's all falling on stocking tops and newly sewn summer dresses. All Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses. All Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses.
We'll always be so much to me.
And welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz, on a very, very special and I wish delicious episode. We have Alexandre Gabriel from Maison Ferrand on the show. Alexandre, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
It's great to be here. It's a pleasure.
While this is a podcast, what I'm looking at on screen is you surrounded by what looks to be like 200 bottles with an iridescent heavenly glow. Where are you calling from?
Right now, I'm on the floating cellar. It's actually one of the many experiments that I love to do. We're aging 1,500 barrels on a huge retired wheat barge on the River Seine in the city of Paris, France. So we're actually aging rum and cognac on a boat. And, you know, why is that? Because you need two beautiful things to make a beautiful spirit, among other things, is the movement. So the liquid shakes slowly into the barrel and the humidity. So that's an experiment. We're doing research about this. And also people get to buy a barrel if they want. So I'm right now in the sample room of the Barge 166 in Paris, where we're aging cognac and rum.
Location undisclosed, but if you listen carefully for the clink of bottles while it's rolling, you might be able to find it. So I want to go actually all the way back because you're so well established and people know who you are, but I kind of want to go back to when you are a small boy. You have said before in the past that your grandfather has said that wealth has come from the earth, and he was the one who taught you about spirits and distillation. Very different time. Very different world, very different era. What was some of the knowledge that he imparted on you, and what are some of the lessons about distillation that you still carry with you today?
Well, it's very many years ago, that's true. I grew up with my grandparents on a farm, a polyculture farm, and over there, South Burgundy, you do wine also. And to me, you know, the wealth of the land for him was beautiful things. You know, what we are is really what we grow. So, you know, the food, what we eat, but also what we drink. And he was a distiller, what we call a bouilleur de cru. Bouilleur de cru, you are allowed to distill what you produce. So, you know, the quality of what you distill, it depends from the quality of what you distill and your skills. And that really is ingrained in me. I like to tell a story. You know, the first time he decided to show me the rudimentary elements of distilling, I was 10 years old. And he said to my grandmother, I'm going to show the kid how to distill. And we were distilling Mar de Bourgogne. Mar de Bourgogne is like grappa. You distill the pomace, the must of the wine. And he said to me as we entered this room, and I was very impressed, he said, first you taste with your ears. And I was like, I was scared he was going to pour this 70% alcohol, 140 proof pomace, distill it in my ears, truly. And he said, what can you hear? And we couldn't hear anything. That meant that the raw material was not compromised by insects or was not decaying, was fresh, he was telling me. And so the quality of what you make and you distill is that first step. Because you don't forget, you know, anything you drink that you see behind a bar, there's somebody growing something somewhere. And that really is ingrained in me. And so that's why when we make cognac, we grow our own grapes. That's why I think we're the only gin back then, for sure. I know people have followed suit, but where we actually grow juniper berries to make gin. You know, soon we'll be growing our own citrus, especially lemons, because we'll use the waste energy of the distillery and to recycle it to grow it into a special room, a big room, big barn, you know, that will be heated by the waste energy of the distillery. So to me, that is really lesson number one, 10 years old. You know, that's what it matters, to make a beautiful spirit, a beautiful rum, a beautiful cognac. Make sure you know what you're using to make it. It sounds stupid, right, Greg? But, you know, there's no miracles. You need beautiful raw material. And that's a concept that's really ingrained into terroir, you know, like where it comes from, where it's grown, how is it grown. And then after, there's the talent, the artistry, obviously, of fermentation, distillation, aging that comes after that. And that's the 33 years of my past years of my life.
Now, was he growing for himself? Was he selling? Was this a personal vintage? What was his setup?
So his setup was very simple. It was very modest. You know, a lot of farmers grew their things, you know, their food, their, you know, I grew up, it seems, you know, since I grew up with my parents and I'm 56 years old, you're talking about the France that these people have learned. You're talking about somebody who fought Second World War, right? So, you know, a bouilleur de cru in France means he distilled his own production. It was a privilege in France back then that was attached to a person. And so, you know, he was growing wine and made fine de Bourgogne, so the distillate of that wine. And then also, remember, on the farm, you don't waste anything. So the pomace, once you press the grapes to make wine, then, of course, you made a spirit with that. And it's funny, you know, now, of course, this is not something you would do. But when you were a kid and you hurt yourself, I was always kind of very energetic and always cut. I have a finger cut. I have a lot of stuff. And, you know, you'd always have a little bit of foolproof ma when you were hurting so bad, you know, while you were going to the doctor. I'm not saying we got hurt on purpose, but you were flying there, you know. And that's, so we grew up around, you know, all of this. And so, yes, that to me was very defining for everything I did since then.
Yeah. So from there, I mean, you had an early education on the spirit side, but then you went to business school, studied business school. You came to the U.S., and then while you were doing kind of your, you know, your senior thesis, you were coming to France and training farmers on business practices. What challenges did you find there, and what lessons did you try to impart on people that were maybe stuck in an older mindset?
Well, it was a bit different. What I did, you know, I didn't pretend teaching anything anybody. I was trying to help, meaning that, think about it, I knew I've been harvesting, you know, my grandfather, the vineyard, my grandparents had a vineyard, my grandmother too. And we, since I'm a kid and I can remember, I can walk, I've been harvesting, right? And then learning how to do the distilling. And so I really grew up in this. And I'm a kind of guy that doesn't take authority. You know, as a kid, you know, as a teenager, I'm much better now, but very well. So I knew I had to have my own little joint. That was my dream. I didn't know what it was. You know, a lot of people tell you they knew what they were doing. I had no clue what I was doing. I just felt I'd love to have my little team and my little joint in. And I didn't know anything about except farming. So I grew up in a really remote part of France, South Burgundy. So I really thought I need to learn English because it seemed to me that English was so important in the, you know, if you wanted to learn from others, you know, around the world. So I went to the US. I went to Minnesota. You know, there, I just thought, you know, over there, there'd be less people speaking French and I'd be learning English. And for some people are telling me some of the best English is in Minnesota. And I went there. That's why I have this accent, I guess. And so, I loved it. I love Minnesota. I think it's such a great state. And then I realized I needed to learn business. And to finance my business school, I started a little firm, very tiny, were four people, to say we could help farmers who produce wine or cognac or sell their products. Because the business school I went to had a branch in New York and another one in Japan. So, and I chose the international program, but I had no money. So I had to find a way. And I thought, you know, I knew I was no genius, but I knew the products. I didn't know much about business, but I knew how to talk about the products. I knew how the way they were made. And we represented products that I understood well and went to see distributors and tried to find, you know, outputs, you know, both in Japan and in France since I studied there. And that was a way to finance our studies. And that's how I met, you know, different producers and decided this is for me. You know, what I grew up into, you know, was really what I wanted to do. You know, some people in my school went into marketing, finance, and they're doing beautifully. And they're dear friends, and I have a lot of respect for what they do. But I thought, you know, farming and making what we sell was something that really meant something to me. So at the time, one of our customers was the Ferrand family, and I bought into the business. It was tiny. There was, you know, the five people that started with me 33 years ago, I'm proud to say three of them are still with us right now, Beatrice, Annabelle, and Sandra. And so we started very small, but and we did a lot of consultant work at that time for other distillers or, you know, throughout the world. You know, we're like the flying distillers or master blenders, because I was surrounded by the other people retired, you know, but now they're retired by far and two passed away, but by very, very skillful people, because this is the part I could judge on, right? And so that's how we started. And then we had one philosophy. Is really, to me, a great cognac is the expression of its terroir, you know, and the terroir, not just the soil, but the techniques, the local know-how, what have been the techniques that have been developed by the hand of women and men making it for hundreds of years. That was really what I based everything I did. And then later on, I discovered, you know, you get to know yourself a little better, that I had a talent for creativity. And so having learned all of this with a lot of modesty, and I was looking at like, tell me about this. How are you making this? You know, and the best way to learn is to always ask why. You know, I don't know if you have children, Greg, but when you have kids, you know, you'll see they always ask why they ask why 10 times, you're like, because, you know, but they've learned so much that way because you're like, okay, you go to your room because it's so many whys. And that's how I've learned a lot. You know, and then I realized I can start making my own things, and I've created a lot of spirits since then.
When you happened upon Miss Enferrand, I mean, many companies now invent a backstory. They come up with a logo and a history, and it's falsified. You came upon a place that had been making cognac for centuries, 10 generations, but they were small. What was it about them out of, you know, the hundreds of businesses that you came across that you felt this was home? What was it that they were doing that you felt that, you know, this was a place to start your business?
You know, things happen when you meet people, I think, you know, and you know, to me, the Ferrand family is three branches. And the Ferrand family is rooted, especially the main branch, the Eli Ferrand branch, is rooted in the history of cognac since the 1600s. But at the time, not much was left. you know, it was almost like starting all over again, or it was kind of a sleeping beauty in a lot of ways. And out of the tree branches was not always easy. It's one of the, you know, and so, and there was somebody who was always to me like a godmother to us. And we were kids, remember, I was 22 years old. So I didn't, half of the things we're doing in business, I had no clue what I was doing because I was still in business school doing this. So it was trial and error. And people don't realize now, they see the brands on many shelves. The first bottles that were in the US, they were in my suitcase, you know, and that's how we started, you know, 33, 34 years ago. So it was really, you know, feeling that, yes, there was this possibility of doing something I love, you know, distilling and creating unique spirits on such a small scale, you know, and that was okay. You know, I was yesterday, the day before yesterday, with Guillaume, actually, in St. Louis with the American Distilling Institute and a gin, you know, it's a big American gin event. And I saw a lot of craft distillers, some of them getting started. And my message is absolutely, you know, if it's your dream, pursue it. If you feel you got it in you, and even if you don't, you know, you can see if it works. And that's the way we did it. I felt I had it in you about the, you know, the knowledge part. Then, but the other rest, the other, you know, we had no clue. I made all the mistakes. You know, a lot of people tell you they could write a book because they know what they're doing. I could write a book on all the mistakes not to do because I've done a lot of them. Over investment, not managing your cash, buying too much production equipment at once, you know, buying the fancy stuff, you know, you're going to make such a beautiful products, and then, you know, you're going to make balance the books and things. The things that I enjoyed and I thought was fantastic, beside creating beautiful spirits, which I love, and that's always a beautiful moment for me, is working with a great team. We have Guillaume here with us. Guillaume and I, we've been working together 24 years. And that's typical of who we are, right? I was proud to tell you, I think working with people who share the same passion is really the reason, and creating beautiful products is the reason I wake up in the morning. And that hit me in the face at an early age. You know, I worked with all the guys that taught me their trade, and I felt it was Christmas every day in terms of learning. Of course, I was hurting because working 16 hours a day and still do. But, having these incredible people you love to work with is a great reward, I find.
And I feel like there's, before we get into a deeper dive on the spirits, I think there's one other piece of the puzzle that you felt almost an existential threat to French Treasures, that you did not feel that some of the spirits and techniques that you were working with were going to make it, were a given. Can you talk about what you felt as a preservationist in your approach to building your cognac business?
Well, this is fascinating to me, and I still do that. I write books about it, actually, and I'm a terrible writer, so I have to work twice as hard to write a good sentence. But it's my way to mine information. I feel that the best way to learn and organize the knowledge. So what I found, you see, we forget about one thing. The 20th century, especially after 1930, is the standardization of spirits. And that is almost throughout all spirit category, almost. And you know, we forgot a lot of these artisanally really crafted products when people will watch a barrel and do all these different techniques. You know, the beautiful deep rums had almost disappeared. There were still distilleries making them, but they were struggling. Everything became more neutral. It was the... Then second part of the century, vodka ruled, you know, the industrial, very neutral vodka. And I have no problem with somebody liking a good vodka, and there's good ones, but most of the vodkas are very neutral in spirits. And while I have respect for anybody else's business, that's not what I was interested in. I was interested in the super rich, intense, very, you know, I love the love handle in the spirits, you know, when there's so much, you know, so much delivery. You know, my grandfather always said, you know, it's like it's got to have a message. It's a book, right? So in the old days, people knew how to do this. And while we're very modern in research and development, we are rooted in history. So when I create the dry curacao, you know, of Pierre Ferrand, we are digging in the true history of Curacao. What is a Curacao? It's not the blue stuff. I don't know if you know, Greg, the blue comes from coal. We want to make the real stuff with the Rara orange, with cognac, with the right distillates. So it's beautiful. So what do? Well, people have been at it since the 1600s. So it would be crazy not to have the humility to say to these people through their books and their writing, teach me. So we go and we get, and then I work with people who share the same passion for learning, such as the historian, the spirit historian, David Wondrich, for example, who's the same way. We listen to these voices from the past because they've been doing it for hundreds of years. You know, as you know now, we're the owners of West Indies Rum Distillery in Barbados. I don't see that, by the way, as an ownership, but more as a marriage. And we have archives going back to the 1893s. So we can really listen and look at these things. And that's culture, right? I look at it much like, you know, a painter will look and go to the museums to paint better. You know, and that's the idea and that's the research. And I've done a lot of this with cognac, with liqueurs, with the dry Curacao, Pierre Ferrand, 1840, with the rums also going back to these very deep, intense, you know, very rich, beautiful rums. That's also that comes with fermentations that were invented in the 1800s. You know, so that's what I find really fascinating.
We're going to take a quick musical break. We're going to play a song from the archives, and then we'll be back with more here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
I believe in the perfect day in the stardust of a melody. This day is a perfect day, leaves fall in time with the song. Thank you.
So I feel we could spend another hour talking about your portfolio because it is wide, it is deep, and it is delicious. Instead of going just into the individual brands, I'd like to know about your approach. Obviously, you started with cognac, but then you introduced rum, gin, and a few others. When you are looking at an exemplary spirit, what goes into it? What is the thought process? And what is, you know, kind of the end goals to add something new to the portfolio?
Well, to me, you see, Greg, a spirit is a vector of emotion, right? Don't you remember, you know, don't you have a smile when you go to bed and you think this time you had with the loved ones or with loved ones or great friends when you shared a beautiful whiskey, beautiful cognac, or these moments are what we and you can't do this if you drink something horrible, you know, and these beautiful spirits are important. So how do you create them is the job of guys like me, you know, and that's really the fuel for us. So when you research that, then you say, okay, I'm going to imagine you're me. You're making cognac, and that's 30 years ago. And during winter, you work like crazy. We're distilling and stuff. You know, we started harvesting. So right now we're harvesting. We start at 2 in the morning, Greg. And we still love it, you know, because it's such a party time when you're finished because you're so tired you could cry because you started at 2 in the morning with the lights of the tractors and the cars because you want the grapes to be super fresh. You don't want to harvest in the beating sun, right? So the whole team is doing this and it's incredible. And then you work like crazy distilling throughout the winter. And then on the 1st of April, your pot stills go silent. And you think, this is crazy if you're me. We could be distilling something else because by law, cognac can only be distilled until the 31st of March. You know, so the wine is super fresh. It's for quality reasons. Makes sense. But for 6 months, the stills are just sitting there. And imagine you're me and you're 25 years old and a bit of an intense guy. And I'm thinking, we could be making something else. And then at the time, there was no craft movement. We had no clue about this. There was the word didn't exist, you know. And so, but I, you know, in France, when I was a kid, drinking age was 16 years old. And so we went out and we drank a lot of bad gin. But I thought gin was a great vector for taste. You know, where cognac is very intense, working on the grapes, and it's beautiful. You distill wine. Think about it. Gin, it's about a total different spectrum of flavors, but it's also about intensity, freshness. You know, summer, you drink a beautiful, fresh gin and tonic that's super aromatic with a little, you know, you're using the skin of a lemon and it's incredible, right? That's what we wanted to create with Citadel. And so we went to see Customs and Excise and we thought, you know, you're young, you think the world is your oysters and you think they're going to be, gee, wish we would have thought about it. And not, that's not what happened. They said, absolutely not. You know, it's illegal. And you say, well, I never saw a law that says I can't. And they say, there's no law that says you can, but they're the government. And I'm just a little farmer. So back then, and so we asked, what should we do? And we worked with them for 5 years until it was available to be doing this. And we launched Citadel in 1996. These 5 years were wonderful years of research, by the way. And so much as we actually created, I have a patent for gin making because we tried everything you could imagine to make a beautiful gin. And so we distilled gin in this beautiful little copper stills, you know, that we have. And then we finally launched it, Greg. And we thought the world for sure was waiting for beautiful artisanal gin. Again, not. Nobody was waiting for it. You know, so it was like, man, you know, like we worked so hard, it was delicious. And I sent it to every British competition, gin competition you can think about. And we won almost every time, like gold medals or first prize. I was like, there must be something into this. But people looked at us, artisanal gin from France, forget it. And then until an incredible guy, a chef called Ferran Adrià in Spain, makes a gin and tonic on TV. And he says, gin and tonic is gastronomic. Keep a bottle in the fridge, you know, and whip it out. Use a great quality tonic. At the time, there was no artisanal tonics, right? So he made himself one because this guy is incredible, a very skillful chef. And he whips out a bottle of Citadel and makes the gin and tonic with Citadel. So that was, for us, wonderful, probably around 1999. I forgot the date. And then the New York Times writes half a page about Citadel called, you know, French Gin Storms the Gate, and saying, you know, it's an incredible gin. And that was the second, you know, you get a break sometimes when you just work tirelessly about what you believe is right. So Citadel, you know, almost couldn't make it. And there's also a great journalist called Papa Court, who early days, when he tasted it blind, said this is what gin was meant to be. And that's in the early days when you lose hope and faith because you're like everything's crumbling, that you think you got the best idea, but the only one who sees that, and the team, I mean my team obviously, we shared that dream. When you finally see this, it's such a beautiful feeling, but everybody worked so hard. Guillaume could tell you, you know, one bottle at a time in the market, telling people the story how it's made so they would be willing to taste it. Once they tasted it, then I think they were on board. And so that's how we did that. And we came into Citadel by just saying, we're going to add something to what we're doing. And then, you know, that opened the door. I was like, okay, we created a patent. We made this beautiful gin. It started doing well. We felt, okay, maybe, you know. And then we sell our secondhand barrels, you know, some of them in the Caribbeans. Cognac barrels. And, you know, 99.999% of rum is aged in bourbon barrels, but some delicious rums are aged in other type of barrels. You know, they're more expensive, the other types, but it's worth the effort. So some of the great distillers contacted, you know, were in contact with us. Whereas, for example, Thierry Gardère, who was the distiller at Barbancourt and the owner at the time. And so I said, I want to see these customers. And I fell in love with rum. You know, we were just working on the gin. And so I went to Haiti, I went to Jamaica, I went to Barbados, I went to St. Lucia, and I fell in love with it. And why? Because the spectrum of taste, but also the method of productions for a guy that is a production guy, seeing how the fermentation, the tradition of making them, and what's beautiful about rum also, each country, each island makes rum, much like food, right, Greg? Every region, you go in France, you go in the Bordeaux area, the Burgundy area, Paris, the food, you know, Brussels, the food is different. Same with every country. And that's very true with beautiful rum. And I thought, that's incredible. And at the time, again, not a business idea. We bought a few barrels, started aging them ourselves in our rum barrels, and people tasted it and they said, you know, you got to launch this. This is delicious. And so that's what we did. And we launched three vintages at first, and then we grew from there. Progressively by cherry picking barrels, shipping them back to France in the barrel as much as we could. Hence this project now where we aging also spirits, you know, on the river here. Just that's called dynamic aging, you know, and then we launched a plantation in 1999, very, very slowly, just of three vintages and that's it. And then people said, oh yeah, we like that. And so we expanded the line. And then to finish on this, you know, we're like, okay, I want to be part of this. I want to be a distiller of rum, you know, because I see these guys distilling and I distill cognac and I distill gin. And we're swapping knowledge like kids swap baseball cards or football cards or, you know, people don't do that anymore. It's all electronic. That dates me a little bit. I'm sorry, Greg. And, you know, and then we have saved some money once. And then finally, when we had enough, we went into a partnership. We purchased West Indies Rum Distillery, again, more like a marriage than a purchase, which also owns a third national rum of Jamaica and Jamaica. So that's when plantation was not only a négociant, you know, aging this beautiful rum. We still, by the way, purchase rums from different islands, the one that I prefer, like incredible Fiji rum, but, you know, Trinidad or St. Lucia or Panama, but most of plantation rum. Of course, the islands are and the countries are all stated. We're very transparent and are from Barbados, where we have a distillery, and Jamaica as well. So that's the story of plantation in a nutshell. And we're trying to, again, celebrate a lot of the traditional methods of rum that I find fascinating. I'll give you just an example, you know, not just to use bourbon barrels, but we do editions every year where we use Pauillac barrels, you know, where we use Chardonnay barrels, where we use Madeira barrels, when we use port barrels, not just, you know, one kind, just to express the beautiful history of rum. And that's fascinating to me.
In completely incredible and just amazing to see the through line of how it evolves naturally. It's easy to say it now in 2022, but to hear a history like that truncated is just phenomenal. Before I let you go, one of the things we spoke about when we met in person was you have this beautiful chateau where the cognac is made. I know marketing and kind of ops are in Paris, but you've got this beautiful estate. You mentioned that you host people, you have artisans there, musicians. So tell me about the scene that goes on in the chateau. Who will you find there? What magic are you making? How are you inspiring each other?
Well, it's funny you say this. It's true. My family, my mother is a sculptor. I love artists. She's classically trained. And I like to say at Ferrand, we are a team of failed musicians. Guillaume is an incredible jazz player, for example. I don't play piano as well as he does, but I've been playing piano for a long time. And so I have a daughter who's went to Berklee School of Music, and she's, so we do love art. For us, it's very important. And I know people see this beautiful chateau and stuff. They forget that when I started, it was raining inside, and we fixed the roof ourselves, by the way. So when you come, Greg, look at the roof. And so it's a nice estate now. We grow our own juniper berries at the Chateau de Bonbonnet. And the minute we could afford it, and once we fixed the main house and the barns, because we had to do this, to this day, we still have artisans. And now there we have 14 guys. There was just one and me in the old days because I worked two shifts back then. And one shift, you know, trying to sell products, the other shift making it or fixing buildings. And, the beautiful things is we decided to fix bedrooms for people to come and visit us, live the life of a producer with us. And we did it, you know, that's how I met the beautiful bar scene, for example. So we have some of the best bartenders from all over the world coming and staying with us. And that's such a communion of knowledge, you know, where they teach me how they use the product. And I like to say, I build the instrument and they play the music, you know, in that case. So we have a huge fire pit. That was Guillaume's idea also, you know, because in France, we don't have fire pits. It's different. We have fireplaces. And so we made it outside. And so when you come, typically, you're going to spend time working with us, either in the fields or checking out the guys or seeing us blending cognac or rum or making gin. We have a distillery there. And then in the evening, we just grill something and eat together and talk and rebuild the world at night until next morning, where we usually get up very early. So it's really sharing a life. And that's basically a life that, I mean, I grew up kind of that way. It was much more rugged, you know, but the way I grew up, but I grew up kind of that way. And to me, everything we do, and my wife and I and the team, we love to share. And isn't spirits about sharing? So sharing knowledge with incredible bartenders, sharing knowledge with people research like Dave Wondrich, we talked about, you know, to create products. I've created spirits, my Stiggins Fancy, you know, pineapple rum. If you would have told me when I was training as a classic master blender in cognac that I would make a pineapple rum by distilling the skin of the pineapples, you know, inspired by a recipe from Victorian era, I would have been, you're crazy. And, you know, so it's a journey, but this journey doesn't happen on your own. It always happens by sharing with others. And really, in the end, that's what it is. Both, not only when we drink it, we share it with others, but I've worked with 50 different master blenders and master distillers in my life. You know, like the artists in the old days, 18th century, used to go from one studio to the other to learn. And to me, it's I worked with the likes of Dave Pickrell, American distiller, incredible. I've worked with, Alex Chatko in Ireland and Carlos Camarena in Spain, et cetera, et cetera. Professor Jong in Korea to learn about clay pot aging. And these guys and us, you know, and incredible bartenders also from all over the world. And we inspired each other. So that's the life at the Chateau de Bonbonnet. And if you know how to play the guitar, Greg, you'll play the guitar. And if you know how to play the piano, you'll play the piano. And we'll have a good evening as well, you know. And if you don't know how to play any of the instruments, you can still play the rum or the gin or the cognac and drink it with us. That's what we're doing at the Chateau de Bonbonnet at night.
Amazing. Well, Alexander, thank you so much for making time. Really appreciate it. How can people find you, get your spirits, follow you, see what, learn more about you? Where do people go?
Well, we are on internet. There's a page, Facebook page at Ferrand, and you know we Maison Ferrand, also Plantation Rum, Citadel Gin, and Ferrand Cognac. and then also have my own Facebook page. I'm not always, you know, on it because I've spent a lot of time making the spirits. That's how they find us. And of course, you know, to me, I always call these spirits my babies. They can find me and they find the whole team's work in every bottle. So, you know, whether it is Plantation, Rum, Citadel Gin, or Ferron Cognac. And my promise to everyone listening is that we'll continue, you know, God willing, all producing these beautiful spirits. I'm a one-trick pony. That's all I know how to do. And making sure we share them together. So to me, that's something that's key.
Amazing. Well, we're going to play another song from our archives, and then we'll be back with the second half of Snacky Tunes here on HRN.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
So, Mahogany, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Really great to have you. Really great to have you here. Why don't you give us a little background on how you two came to be?
Well, this iteration of the band is about 4 years on. I've actually been putting out records since 1997.
Really?
Yes. I first got onto John Peel, and ever since then we've been asked to make records and do performances and radio shows.
So, holy shit, you met John Peel.
We did not meet him. We had him play our records sometimes at both speeds. He liked one particular song at 33 and 45.
Really?
So, yes. So my friends in England would tape the show and send it to me after he played the records.
Oh, my God.
That's how we got started.
Tape the show and send me a cassette, my friend.
Yes. Yeah, so I started out in Michigan outside of Detroit. It's fairly empty there, and moved to New York in 99. So.
Oh, shit. So you've been in New York. You've seen the changes.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where did you first move?
Brooklyn. So I lived up in Greenpoint.
So you've seen some shit.
I've been all around. I managed two different recording studios here, one which was over at Morgan and Grattan, and the other one, the Civil Defense, is now in the Gowanus area.
Do you have any stories of when you first moved to Greenpoint that would make people who moved to Greenpoint today cry and be like, I have no idea it was ever that bad?
Well, Bushwick was kind of more like that.
Yeah.
With lots of burned out cars and packs of dogs, so you would be better off on a bike.
Packs of dogs?
Packs of wild dogs, that kind of thing. Yeah. It was the Badlands, man. It was really, really interesting.
Where do the packs of wild dogs go now? Like, do they just get rid of them? Kill them? Yeah. I don't know. You ever seen The Leftovers? They're not our dogs anymore.
It's like the Sochi Olympics.
It's good. Watch it. Yeah. Yeah. So then, how did this iteration come into place?
Well, I was working on a record with a very large group of people, and I kind of finished with that, and I actually was working for Christie's, the auction house, and I...
What were you doing for Christie's?
I was doing graphic design for a magazine that if you spend $1 million at Christie's, they'll send you the magazine. It's called Highlights.
No.
No. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And so then if you look at a photo, would you find the Monet where it was hidden?
Oh, no, I'm saying if you went
That's a Highlights original.
Right, right. We're thinking of Highlights for Children, which we did try to tell them, you know, this is already a magazine, but...
And that they're really into that the everyone idea. Has read.
That, yes, like Boy's Life, yeah.
Hey, have you ever been to a dentist? It's in there. Okay, well, we can talk about there. But anyway, so you were Highlights.
Right, I was there, and then I met Jacqueline through a mutual photographer friend. Because I was spending some time in Philadelphia, and I kind of go back and forth pretty much equally. So we both do, really. We have a name for it. We call it New Phil York Adelphia.
Interesting.
Phil so York. It's part of our futuristic commuter existence.
The Sixth Borough. Remember that article?
They've been saying that. I found a poster from 1848, and they've been saying that ever since then, when they first built the railroad, lest we become the Sixth Borough.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's been something that's been perennially on people's minds.
Well, we're from right outside Philadelphia.
Oh, right on. Cool.
Yeah. Have you been to the Dolphin yet?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So good.
It's fantastic.
It's a fantasy of a club.
We've got some pictures of her getting down on Instagram, so you can check those out.
Which is Mahogany_band.
Mahogany_band.
So how did you get in the mix? When did you start doing music?
With Andrew, actually. I was a ballerina growing up. And I had no real musical experience until I met Andrew through this photographer, and he kind of showed me the ropes and was like, let's do this, and threw me right in front of a 12-string guitar and kind of has been my mentor.
Fuck you and your 6-string. Yeah. We're going straight to 12.
You know, yeah. There's only 2 people in the band. We need all the strings we can get.
Yeah.
And how was that, like, going from no musical background? Obviously having some sense of rhythm from being a ballerina, but, like, no actual... How long did it take for you to be like, I'm not just like kind of playing the same thing from memory over and over again?
Right. I mean, it's kind of like the same thing with dance, muscle memory, but it took a few years, and Andrew's a really tough teacher, so, which is great and totally beneficial. But, I mean, here we are 4 years later since we met, and this is where we're at.
What is one of your, like no-hold-barred teaching, like, rules or methods?
plug the guitar in. Like, don't sit in bed, like, in your panties playing the guitar with no amplifier. So that's kind of, like, the rule. I mean,
that's,
at the home.
I mean, I feel like that's where I got lost. That was just, like, in bed playing in my panties. And just,
it's just fun.
Yeah. Would you, like, tape the guitar to her hands and be like, I'll untape it when you get the song right?
No, we just started out with really, really simple things to play that were already kind of part of the songs. Because there's, like, plenty of things that, I mean, most of the music is kind of like a lot of repeated motifs that get sort of cycled through, like Steve Reich or Philip Glass or something like that. You know, I grew up with those composers. Right. I grew up as a cellist, so I took in my conservatory freshman year to finally realize I wanted to look at other instruments and production, music production. Most of the music I've done is actually, from a production standpoint, has been for other bands.
All right, well, let's hear a song. Let's hear some of this. Right. What are you going to play for us?
This is actually from our newest record, which will be coming out in the fall, and we're doing a tour. We'll be in New York, Boston, L.A., a lot of other places.
Can we come to the show?
So this is called Keystone Sonata.
Empire, a new horizon. by their thrones. We were walking logically, standing at the keystone.
Oh, man.
That was great.
Dude, that's awesome. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure the people at home can hear how much you were smiling during that song. I feel like it gives that extra oomph.
It's emancipation, you know?
It's great, man. That's real, get-up-and-go Sunday sunrise music.
Jubilation. We did a version of this as a video that you can find on South by Southwest, their YouTube channel.
Oh, really?
We did that a couple years ago. And we've been working on this song for a while now, just adding synthesizer, adding guitars, and a bunch of stuff. So
pretty layered.
And it is sort of about, you know, the sort of Philly pride type thing.
I would like to see that with a full orchestra. I'm just saying. I feel like that song.
Yeah, totally. We'll when we get the budgeting, we'll.
Yeah. Well, the money you're saving on not eating gluten alone is halfway there.
No, what you should do is you should palm highlights and then sell them for $500,000. Yeah.
Well,
let's do it.
Well, that's the other thing is that we have thought about maybe we could see what you guys think of this idea of a book caravan, because I also do book design for Rizzoli. So I've done three different books with Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth. If you look up Mixtape, The Art of Cassette Culture, this is a book that I brought together with a group of my friends, and then we pitched it to the publisher, and they said, it's great, but we want to get Thurston, we get somebody famous on it or whatever, so we got Thurston on it. And we ended up doing a few other books, Grunge, which is the photography of Michael Levine, and Punk House, Interiors in Anarchy, which is interesting interior decorated book, somewhat food related.
Is it like modern punk houses? Like
squats from across. So yeah. Abby Banks is the girl who did all of the photographs. She's brilliant.
Man, you guys are just creative forces, putting it out across all mediums.
That's the point. I mean, isn't that what we're supposed to do in this McLuhan-esque age? Is just, hit all fronts.
Go for it.
Absolutely.
Full spectrum dominance.
I mean, that's one of the great things about working across all mediums. I know that Greg and I work in, we did TV, we did radio, we do events, things like that. And just, at the end of the day, it's just about the creative process and putting out something.
Yes.
And it doesn't really matter being pigeonholed into one, sort of going like, oh, I thought you just did music. That's done. That's over.
Yeah. I mean, I think that especially after the 80s, it's kind of impossible to not have a visual for your music. And I mean, it used to matter not what even people looked like. Now it's actually pretty critical.
And how would you describe the visuals for your music?
Well, we do a lot of filming where we're just, I mean, if you're familiar with, you're familiar with Philadelphia, we'll just go deep into the north where everything's falling apart and do some frontiering as we'll call it. Just the urban landscape is really interesting. So a small HD rig and just take that out. And then we also do a lot of animation at home.
Really?
So, yeah.
What type of animation?
Mostly just with color and like markers.
Oh,
you
awesome.
Know what I'm saying? Like just
like stop motion stuff?
Yeah, but abstract. So.
And then we were looking at your website. Can you talk about the ballet performance you did in the subway?
Sure. I've been working with this Instagram follower, cat_in_NYC, and she's got hundreds of thousands.
Dude,
of
Cat NYC.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
She's awesome.
She's amazing.
Russian woman, super great.
I met her a few months
ago.
We did this Insta meetup, and she's just I was like, oh my God.
She's super cool.
She's super cool.
She's an amazing guy.
We've been working together on these shoots, and basically I work in Lower Manhattan as a separate thing from the music, and we meet up on my lunch break, go down and underground for an hour, take photos, and I put on some ballet stuff, and one of the shots ended up in the Huffington Post recently.
It's amazing. Is it like a Superwoman change where you like the leotards underneath and you just bust out of the phone?
Yeah, kind of. To save time, I've been wearing a leotard underneath the work clothes, but my boss did come up to me and was like, I saw you on the popular page. I'm like, oh,
wow.
Shit.
It's during lunch.
Yeah, I know. I was like, well, it's my lunch hour.
Yeah. Wow, I saw you on the popular page. Man.
It's a song lyric.
So that's great, though. That's so much fun. And
it
are you
is.
Dancing in the subway? Or are you
yeah,
just doing
yeah,
poses?
Yeah. We're going back back and forth. I mean, it depends. Like, some of the shots are in Soho. Some were, we had more room and the street was a different surface. Then we could do more dancing shots and, like, turning and stuff. But most of our videos, the two videos Andrew and I have done together, we've done some choreography and
that's all.
She's been humble.
My dancing, since I was a kid, I was in the pit orchestra because I knew right where I should be. But I would just like to say that, I mean, you know, she's just a genius, really. I mean, there's a lot that's behind it. She's being very humble. So what happened on screen there?
Oh, sorry. Someone's got eye bleeding. But wait.
We have an eye injury.
Eye bleeder.
Are you as hard as a teacher on him about dancing as he was you about teaching?
I've been trying to get Andrew to come to a ballet class.
Andrew, don't dance around in your bed, in your panties.
I know.
Yep.
Get up.
Put your leotard on. Put your shoes on.
It's comfortable.
It's comfortable.
I mean, do we have dreams of a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers type thing? We're working on it.
Well, you know, Ginger Rogers had to do everything Fred Astaire, but backwards, right?
Right, yeah. Right,
so. And in heels. Why don't we get another song?
Yeah.
All right.
What are you going to play for us?
This next song is called Commutator, and it's the second song off of our upcoming record.
Awesome. Okay, here we go. Mahogany Light with Snacky Tunes.
All right.
The children, the silence is all the guns. A measure for the lost, and a measure for the fallen. A measure for the lost, and a measure for the fallen. A measure for the lost, and a measure for the fallen. A measure for the lost and a measure for the fallen.
Well, I think the entire country of Germany should thank Mahogany for sending out those posse vibes.
Ja, so sehr ausgezeichnet. Ganz toll. Goal? Special ambition.
Goal? Holy shit.
I'm mayor.
So how do you guys inspire each other in the creative process? Because you guys are obviously both creative in your own factions, but are the is the like sum greater than the parts when you two get together?
1 + 1 = 3 or more.
Yeah, seriously. But I'm
that's
serious.
Actually a title of our song, a song of ours. But
I mean, seriously, like, you guys are really. It's intimidating in a way because you're hitting. You're really like sort of covering every. You know, it's graphic design, books, dance, music. It's just there's not a lot that other people can really bring to the table. So when you guys get together, is it just like this like ball of inspirado?
Well, we did some research and the word that we found was charrette.
Yes.
Describes sort of a workshop attitude towards like needs based, getting things done in the moment. Like sort of, so we don't like, I don't know that there's a significantly consistent process. It's more or less like we know we have a couple hours. What do we got to do?
Charrette.
Charrette. Charrette.
What, English?
I guess it used to be French.
Used
but
to
it
be
was
French.
Anglicized. Yeah. So more meaning an architectural sort of get down.
How did you find this word?
I forget.
Because it's related to people who, students who would cram to create models for architecture finals. That's where this context I saw it in. So.
Huh.
Yeah.
It's a good word.
Thanks.
They're not really, I guess, writing sessions. They're like creative sessions.
I mean, it's just sort of like this. The songs, for example, in some cases they write themselves. Like Keystone, there's a word in that, vicissitudes, which means regular changes.
Okay.
Right. I had no idea what the word meant, but I apparently had heard it at some point previous, and it came out in the lyrics when I was writing one day. So I had to go look it up in the dictionary after that.
Before we
so it's sort of needs based. Like, if you just see what's going on, and then we just have to jump in.
And sometimes you need a dance part. Sometimes you need a guitar solo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah,
but you have to be dressed for both.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, and
well, you could be in your panties.
Not just
actually.
In your
you have to be plugged in.
Well,
yeah.
Plugged in. I'll put it this way: when I hear the panty session, I know it's going to be like B sides and like.
I'm loving this.
So
idea.
Wait, so the new album you keep talking
new
about?
EP. I know.
New EP.
It's crazy what's happened to that record.
Go on.
Well. I basically have been writing it since 2006 when the last one came out. Then we went on tour with Block Party the next year and then went down to Lima, Peru a bunch, which has if you want food,
yeah,
Lima and its sushi fusion is a completely different universe. But we went down there a bunch and we've just been playing shows ever since really and trying to put the record together. But I'm not, like I said, I'm not like a careerist person, so I'm not going to like rush to put something out that isn't what I think should be.
By the way, 2006 Block Party, I mean, talk about touring a band at the top of there. That must have been awesome.
They're fantastic.
They're great. They're awesome.
They're really nice to have us along. I mean, playing, you know, the Carling Circuit was, you know, that's probably the biggest crowds we've ever had. 5,000 people throwing glow sticks at us.
Of course.
You know, and right. In Blackpool was, you know, if you've done your research, the Stones started a riot there, Velvet Underground, everybody. So when they threw the glow sticks at us, I was very pleased.
You felt like you had made your...
made our impact. Yeah. Well, that's actually the home of one of my favorite bands. It's a Factory Records band called Section 25 that Ian Curtis produced, actually. So, okay. Yeah, I love those guys.
So EP comes out next week?
It's coming out. well, we have a tour going around it. EP will probably be out, what, the 12th?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And where's the tour is hitting all over?
Yeah,
it kicks off in Philadelphia, actually.
Where in Philadelphia?
At the World Cafe Live.
That's on the 12th, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Amazing. And shout out to World XPN, right?
Oh, yeah, right on. Yeah, totally. Love them.
And then where are you playing in New York?
We'll be in Brooklyn at Glasslands Gallery.
What's that?
And that's with Psychic Twin.
Yep.
On 13th?
Yep.
Can we come?
Yep. Yeah, and then we'll be in Boston, and we've got a show in L.A. at the Echo for Part-Time Punks. Yep. We'll do another radio show out there with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, well, I mean, shout out to Glasslands. I love Rami. Like,
yeah, like, Rami's awesome. He's so sweet.
Rami is, like, one of the nicest, best,
I feel
awesome
like you can probably there. Speak to this since you've been here in Brooklyn for so long. Even though they didn't start till 4 or 5 years ago, they're sort of one of the last true, just, like, supporters of the arts and music and things like that.
Oh, Glasslands?
Yeah.
Oh, this band actually opened that venue.
Oh, really?
Mahogany, yeah,
In 2006 or 7 with the Sentimentalist magazine.
So you know the original girls.
Yeah, we were there quite a bit. But every time we would play, we would blow out the power.
So I they've done that's an amazing fault. Job.
No, it's fantastic. Like, no, the light sound is incredible.
Yeah. I have the bear head that used to be in there.
Hanks and it's in my apartment.
You have that?
Yeah.
I harassed Brooke for it, like, because you know they changed out the venue like every 2 months.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, cool, when you take that down 2 months, can I have it? But that was like the last iteration they had done. Uh-huh. And I then harassed her every month for like 4 years. And then she called me one night. She's like, we're selling it to Top Gun, the whole venue.
No.
If you come down now with $400 in cash, it's yours. But you have 2 hours to make
it's
a decision.
Like a Craigslist deal.
They still have, we get dinner out of this.
They still have the weird like fur one that's in behind the bar.
Uh-huh.
So why don't you give people how they can find you? Instagram, Twitter, website, everything before we get into this last song.
Sure. On Facebook, we're at facebook.com/mahoganyinternational. On Twitter, we're mahogany_intl. Instagram, mahogany_band. And our website, where you can find all our news and our calendars on there. And you can subscribe to our newsletter. That's mahogany.nu.
Awesome. Right. And when are the mahogany practice panties coming out? I'm sorry, is that...
Those will be what the tour we're going to do is silkscreen.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, we'll be selling them on the site as well.
Okay, awesome. And they're just going to say, get up out of bed.
Get up out of bed and practice. Yeah. or they'll say, plug it in. Is what
plug it in.
Oh. Yeah. Oh. Quarter inch.
Okay,
table.
Okay.
And in your spare time, you write jokes.
Yeah. Punch-ups for Hollywood. Well, thank you to everyone. I think we're off again next week, and then we're back on the final run, knock on wood, to episode 200. If you are in town this Tuesday, we are doing our next barbecue blowout. Just go to... BBQ blowout July 2015 .eventbrite.com 2014. Leah Cohen is going to be on the grills. Ducky is going to be on the decks. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Rain or shine.
Chris, congratulations again on everything.
Thank you for having me.
And we got one more song. What do we got?
Go Germany.
This is called White Rooms.
Oh yeah. And congratulations to Germany and to all of the friends we met in Berlin. This one goes out to Bergheim, I think. We'll see you in a few weeks. Always be so much to me.
Jackie left a little laugh, speaking desire. We cannot just begin. I miss you very much. To cry together every day, we have to stay in touch. And Jackie, baby, take my hand, smooth your tresses. Tears are falling on stocking tops, and newly sewn summer dresses. Oh, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses. Oh, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses.
We'll always be so much to me, always me, so much to me, will always be, so much to me, will always be, so much to me.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.